A little while ago, I was listening to a podcast about synesthesia and I learned some things.
What did you learn? Because I accidentally discovered a friend of mine had synesthesia when I was about 16.
Well, it might be helpful if we start just vaguely describing what synesthesia is to people who have no idea what we're talking about, bearing in mind none of us are doctors or psychologists or whatever sort of person you should need to properly define this. But essentially, it's a neurotype where people kind of have a crossover of senses. So a classic one that you hear a lot is where people might associate a particular color with numbers or with particular numbers. So they might say that the color 8 is always blue. And that might mean that they have a strong association in their mind. They always think of that color. Or it might mean they literally see that color in front of their eyes when they see or hear the number 8. But it can cover a lot of senses. In fact, this podcast was called The Taste of Words, because one of the cases that they were focusing on in that podcast was about a person who, when they hear certain words, they get a taste in their mouth. And that is interesting, but can also be extremely unpleasant for them and difficult with certain people because certain people's names taste disgusting to them.
This is so wild. I mean, initially when you said, when you put in the show notes synesthesia, I'm aware of an AI tool called Synesthea, and it threw me because I thought you were talking about that. And this is a whole stupid AI tool that records your face and makes videos and stuff. And I thought you were going to talk about that. I'm quite glad you didn't. But then you started talking about people's names tasting disgusting, and I'm not sure.
Yeah, I first learned about this when I was about 16, 17, and one of my friends learned to drive. He was the oldest in our age group and learned to drive first. And as he was driving us around after he passed his test, he made a throwaway comment of, "I really hate the sound the orange lights make." And everyone was like, "What now?"
Right, so that was, yeah, another one where I guess the color or the visual of the light is triggering a sound response.
Yeah, right. I know none of us are doctors, but is this crossed wires in the brain or like the sensory bits like hooked up wrong? Or is this, without wishing to ascribe someone with this as wrong, is their brain wired differently? Do we know what
essentially
causes?
Yeah, from what I gather. So I heard the same professor who was on this podcast, which was an episode of Curious Cases. She was also on The Life Scientific, which is another BBC podcast. And that was basically what she was saying, was that it's to do with the way that the brain's pathways are wired up. They tend to have, I think it's also something that applies with autism and with ADHD to some degree, in that basically there are connections across the brain which don't happen so much with neurotypical brains, basically. So therefore it means that things which a lot of people don't get triggered across do get triggered across with people with synesthesia.
Is this the science program with Dr. Hannah Fry?
Yes. So this is Dr. Hannah Fry, and it was originally Adam Rutherford, but is now Dara O'Brien. That's right. Curious Cases. Life Scientific is Jim Al-Khalili. Yes. Cool. quick overview of BBC Science podcasts there. So let's go back to the things that I've learned. So two things I learned. One is that the word synesthete, which is the word for a person who experiences synesthesia, which I thought was interesting because, yeah, I've heard before that, I've watched various documentaries about it, and I'd never actually heard a word that is used as sort of like a noun for a person with synesthesia. It was always a person with synesthesia. But I thought synesthete is quite a pleasing word to use.
Is it? I don't know. It ends a bit abruptly for me. But then this is another example of everyone's brain's a bit different.
Yeah. But the other thing which I found was more surprising was that I am one.
Oh. Okay, yes. Then.
So towards the end of the podcast, they started talking about some people who they were studying who, when they were exposed to certain concepts, they would find a very vivid memory of a place they had been appear in their mind, and they would feel like they were there. And as I was listening to this, I thought, oh yeah, I do that.
Have you got an example? Like,
well, so one of the things that they talk about on the podcast is the person, whenever they thought of feminism, they went to a place in their mind where they'd been on holiday in rural Ireland.
Okay.
Yes, which is a bit of a strange connection. But the point is that the place that they were remembering had nothing to do in their life with the idea of feminism. It's not like they were studying feminism in Ireland.
Okay. Or saw a play by Jermaine Greer or something location.
Okay. So it isn't that experience of smelling the aroma of a food that you've had before and being taken back to a place where you ate that food, where there's obvious connection.
It's not triggering the memory, it's triggering another memory which isn't related to the thing you're experiencing.
Now my silly brain is trying to rationalize this and feels like, is this like cross-linked files on a file system?
You must find a metaphor for this, Alan.
Yes, I'm
lost plus found.
Yes. So when I realized that this was a thing I do, I emailed the professor, I think it's Julia Simner, who was appearing on the podcast, and said, I think I have this thing you're talking about, and described my experiences. And she said, oh, actually, yes, that is right. Would you like to be part of our study?
Oh, wow.
So since then, I've basically done an online survey going through, which basically asks a bit about, you know, what triggers and what memories have you experienced, and then gives you a list of, you know, when you think about this concept, where do you bring to mind? And it's, you know, a list of various things. Now, where all this relates to Linux, which I'm sure you're eager to hear, when I was going through this list, it was all like abstract stuff, like, as I say, feminism and like justice and, I don't know, art and like really high level abstract concepts that they were asking about. And I was going through and thinking, well, I don't really have any particular thing that comes to mind with any of these. And it might be that if you ask me the same things again now, I would put the same things that I put then. But what happens for me is very specific technical topics or technical operations that I do. So, for example, if I have to change the URL of a Git remote in a Git repository, I get a very vivid memory of the gym at my secondary school.
Wow. That I would, I was not going to, like, when you started talking about technical, I was thinking, oh, he's going to think of steampunk or like cogs or something. But this is just like wildly unrelated, isn't it?
Yes, this is literally like specific things I do or specific topics that I look up. So another one I realized, because I've been, since I did this study, I've now been taking a note of everything that I realize is one of these, because they happen quite often, but I don't realize, because it's such a background thing for me that it's always going on.
Right.
I don't think, oh, that's one of those necessarily. I realize I've been thinking about a place, and then after a while I go, oh, it's because of every time I'm doing this.
Yeah, this was the situation with my friend Andy. You know, we got to 1617 and he had just assumed that we all heard these sounds when we saw or experienced particular colours and what have you. Hadn't occurred to him at all that this was something distinctive.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of always assumed that this wasn't a common thing. You know, why would, because, you know, these are all places that are very specific to me. Like, so obviously other people aren't going to be having the same connections, but I never realized that it was a significant thing. Hence why I'd never made a note of it before, because it's useless. I can't do it in reverse. I can't say, you know, there's that place. And if I think of that place, I then remember the concept or the operation that I'm doing. Well, it's like
that's not very helpful,
a useless reverse memory palace.
It reminds me very much of the thing you often see where people discuss the difference between having an internal monologue and not having an internal monologue.
Yes.
And people who have one find it bizarre that people don't.
Yes.
Or the other weird one that I've heard is, there are two ways that people wipe their backside after going to the toilet. You either sit down or you stand up. And both sets of people think it are incredulous that the other people exist. And that's, it's a, it's a weird thing that you don't know what's going on inside someone else's head, and you will never know unless you know, you go through a study like yours.
Yeah, no, another example, in fact, that Professor Simner gave on one of the podcasts was that she discovered she has something called aphantasia, which is where you cannot picture things in your mind.
Right.
And while she was studying some of the people with synesthesia, she said to one of her colleagues, well, they were talking to me about this amazing thing they do where they bring pictures in their minds. And they were like, everybody does that. What are you talking about? That's nothing to do with synesthesia. But yeah, I find it really hard to imagine that someone can't do that.
Yeah.
But I can very much imagine that people don't do what I do. But I also find it a bit strange that I do. And it's a shame that it's not more useful.
So is there some common ground in the actions that you perform that trigger these sensations? Like, are they all to do with, you know, programming or technical stuff? Or is it completely random?
Yeah, everything I've sort of specifically identified so far is related to some sort of command line commands or some sort of programming concept. I mean, yeah, the big ones are, yeah, that Git remote thing. If I have to restart a systemd service, that's one. That's the geography corridor at school.
That's not been around very long.
That's the geography corridor.
Well, I think it might have
also
been the same for Upstart as well. I think that might have led on from that, but it's the same location. There was one other, hold on, if I bring up my notepad a second.
So, for example, if you did like Telinit 6 or something or whatever it was before Upstart, is it always Upstart, like daemons, like these, like init systems?
It's that process of restarting a system service and working out, while I'm working out whichever command it is I need to run, that sort of location, I'm imagining myself standing in that bit of my school. The other one I've noticed is whenever I have to think about secure boot, that location is the top of town in Basingstoke. And my school wasn't in Basingstoke, so it's not specifically places in my school.
We've only met there on a few occasions for tea and curry.
But I used to walk through the top of town every day when I went to college, but I wasn't doing anything to do with secure boot at college, so I don't know why it's there.
I mean, this could be the longest episode of this podcast ever, as we question you on like every command you type and what part of North Hampshire it reminds you of. But is there any outcome from this research? Is there like, are you in therapy for this, or is it it's just a thing and it's fine? Is it just gathering knowledge for the medical research?
Yeah, I mean, basically, they haven't done any follow-up with me, so I guess I probably wasn't that interesting compared to some of the other people. But for me, it's not anything I need to deal with. It's just a thing that's going on, which I now find more interesting than I used to. But it's still useless. It doesn't bother me. It doesn't help me with anything. It's just an interesting thing. And I thought the fact that it's always Linux-related things, it might be also interesting to people listening to this show.
I was going to say, it's not useless. It's filled in 15 minutes of a few thousand people who listen to this show. And I think that's worth doing.
You never know who else is out there listening to this thinking, oh, that's me.
Yeah.
Well, yes. If you have location memory synesthesia, do get in touch via the form on our website.
I audited some of my Git repos, and you'll be amazed what I found out.
Did you find signs of development or being a developer among your Git repos?
No, but the last one will shock you.
Go on, then.
So the reason for doing this is I am somewhat envious, Martin, and I don't mind saying this to you. I'm kind of envious of the effort you've put into your profile on GitHub, your multiple profiles on GitHub, where it's all very well-structured and there's consistency both visually and technically between one Git repo and another. Like there's always a good comprehensive README. there's GitHub Actions, there's all the kinds of stuff that you would expect to be there if someone was coming along and visiting your profile or visiting a specific repo in your org. I admire that. And I think it's a really excellent thing that you've spent clearly some time to do. And I have not, because my GitHub profile consists of a whole bunch of repos, many of which were created a long time ago and are things like Snapcraft YAMLs for snaps that I started maintaining maybe 5 years ago. And all I do now is just bump the version number, make sure it works, and publish the version in the stable channel. And so there's no expectation that anyone else is going to contribute to that. Sometimes I get issues filed on them, but not very often. Usually it's just, oh, this is out of date, or this no longer works, or it doesn't work on a particular setup. So I haven't really made any effort in making them look nice. They're not like pieces of software that I've created. It's just a bit of config for a packaging, you know, packaging tool. And so I felt there's no real need to. And then I thought, well, why not actually make a tiny bit of effort, the minimum effort required, to make it look slightly less like trash and a dumping ground of like YAML files from the past. And so I thought, well, what I'll do is feed it all into a machine and say, tell me what I'm missing. What should I do? Give me a to-do list of things I should do to spruce this up. Because what I keep doing is looking at one of the repos, like, for example, one of the snaps that I maintain is again called Classic Cube, which is a Minecraft re-implementation for low-end computers. And I was looking at it today. I thought, oh, this is a bit of a mess. It's not great. There's some automation missing. I could really improve this. And so that was the trigger, was seeing one of them and thinking, oh God, I've got, if I do this one, there's the other 50 that I also have to do. And then I thought, well, yeah, but I don't have to do all of them. And if I do one, then I'll feel bad that I haven't done the others. And if I only do a README, if I limit myself to just updating the README, then that feels like not enough. I should really do the automation. And so my brain was going 1,000 miles an hour thinking, what should I do? And so that's why I ran this thing to say, check all of these repos. Tell me what I should do. And it's given me a hit list. And I thought you might want to hear what some of the things it suggested I should do.
Yeah, I do. So first of all, thank you for the compliment. And it's interesting because if I'm the high bar you're shooting for, my internal critic is telling me all the time, I have no consistency in the GitHub Actions that I'm using. And wouldn't it be good if Dependabot always had tests? So when Dependabot runs and has a thing it wants to bump, a test could run, and if the test passed, just auto merge it. So I've got all of these things on my mind about how I could do things better, or rather do things so that I'm less involved in the churn of maintaining these things. So I am interested to learn what you've learned, because I want to build a tool to improve my estate of stuff that I've got on GitHub.
Estate. So just to knock you down a peg or two, it wasn't just you. Last night we had a meetup at work at our event space, and one of the speakers that I arranged was John Seeger, VP of Engineering at Canonical. And we had lots of chats before he got up on stage. And partly what I was talking to him about was inspired me to do this, because he talks about some of the apps that he's developed recently and the tooling he's developed recently. Obviously, it's all written in Rust because he's a massive Rust fan. But also he talked about the real vigor he has in maintaining these things with tests and like automation and stuff. And I was like, oh God, I feel terrible. So it's a mix. It's a mix of looking at your repos that look amazing and then hearing from John, like from his first person point of view of how amazing he is, and me like deciding I'm terrible and I need to fix these things. So,
okay, I'm hearing it. I'm going to rescind the compliment to your compliment, because clearly it has nothing to do with me. It's all about John.
It's not. It's really not. Anyway, Let me give you a couple of things. So some of the things, there's a lot of these things are snaps, right? And so, and they've evolved over time. So the first thing it showed me was the inconsistency of the snap base, the cores that are used. So some of these things are old. So there's a couple of them. One of the snaps in my archive is based on core 18. So that's 1804. And this has been marked as a critical thing I need to fix. Critical. End of life, 1804. So I need to do that. Five of them are core 20. 19 are core 22. So that's Ubuntu 2204. 11 are core 24. I know for a fact two of them only became core 24 today because I fixed them today. So actually, it was fewer than that. So that's given me just like one little thing without doing readmes or automation. This is like these things are based on old libraries in old releases of Ubuntu. I should bump these. Now, I realize this is very much a me problem. There are not many people out there with 50 snaps in the store. Probably less than 10.
Well, okay, but that's an implementation detail. You have 50 things of that particular type, but there is probably node developers out there that have got 50 npm packages, for example, that aren't being lifted and maintained in a consistent fashion.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. Thank you for that. I appreciate your kindness there. So the second category, this is all very much therapy for me. The second category was missing readmes, and it found seven repos. Now, again, these are just snaps, and they are just repos that basically contain a YAML and a desktop file, and that's about it. But I feel like if someone stumbled on it and wanted to understand what it was a snap for, they're not going to find that without a readme. So there's seven repos that could be improved with just a readme. That feels like a quick and easy win. It's highlighted six repos that have no CI at all. But the interesting thing is, of those, I think three or four of those six get no updates upstream. And so, my mind has said, well, they're basically abandoned upstream. Why should I bother rebuilding them every week or every day or whenever? There's no point because they're never updated. But that's not the point, because it's not just the app that's in that snap. There's all the libraries that are in there as well, and the tool chain and the drivers and all that kind of stuff. So thinking about it, like, you know, with the right state of mind, yeah, that's a good idea. I should add GitHub Actions to all six of those projects. Next up is some inconsistencies between my GitHub Actions. I have a bunch of these. One of the YAML files. Now, this is interesting because the YAML file doesn't really matter, does it, for a GitHub Action? Does anyone care about the name of the YAML file?
It should be the same, right?
I've got one called blank.yaml.
Oh, I see. Snapcraft YAML.
Yeah, I could have called it null. Yeah, I could have called it null.yaml. And actually, there are four snaps of old vintages. So these are old things I've had snapped for a while. And there's four of them that have blank.yaml. I've got a bunch that are build.yaml, and one of them that is build.yml, or one that's YAML and the rest are YML. So I've even got an inconsistency on the extension of the YAML file. So that's wrong. I've got a whole bunch that are the same, so that's good. I've clearly copy and pasted, cargo culted from one repo to a bunch of others, and some which are almost the same name, but maybe a plural missing or something. They're just not quite the same. So the tool recommended that I standardize on one because that's the most common one that I've used everywhere. And so that makes sense.
What, blank?
Do you know what it's called? It's called test, snap, can build. That's what it's called, which I think is pretty descriptive.
Yes.
Test that it can build. Like, that's right. I'm regretting this. I really am. Then the other thing is automating things. So sometimes when a snap gets outdated in the store, that's because upstream have released a new version and I haven't kept up with my YAML because the packaging in my repo is not in sync with the version that's upstream. And so I've got some automation in some of the repos, which goes and looks in the upstream repo, looks for whatever the most recent release is, compares it with what's in the store, and then does something. And in most cases, what it does is it just ninjas the YAML file and changes the line that says version equals one to version equals two. And that will then trigger the CI to do a build. Now, there's some inconsistencies here as well, because some of them just go and touch the YAML file directly, whereas others will do a pull request. And I completely forgot I did that. So I have some repos where they have loads of open pull requests, which are trying to ninja the version number because the upstream version has changed.
Oh, yeah, I remember that stuff. Yeah.
And also, there are some of the GitHub actions that rely on, or GitHub workflows that rely on other actions whose versions are outdated. And so at some point, I've probably got an email from Dependabot or something saying, hey, this is using Action V2 and you should be using Action V4 or something like that.
That sounds like you don't have Dependabot set up at all, because it would create a PR for you to do the revision.
I may refer you to my previous conversation where I said I have open PRs that I've not done anything with. I'm a terrible developer. Also, another couple of small things, missing license files. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's common. Mm-hmm. Also, default branch names. I've got an inconsistency where 17 of them are still called master and 19 of them are called main, because GitHub changed the default, at some point.
Do you have any others?
No, I only have master and main.
Blank.
It's a great question. It's a perfectly reasonable question, given who you're talking to. But yes.
Renaming the main branch or the master branch or whatever, though, is a bit of a faff. You could
not,
probably get away with it for yours.
Nah. Yeah. Yes, you're right.
Well, if no one else is contributing.
Yeah, exactly. If it's a project people are contributing to, that can be a huge pain point
Other contributor to this project is Dependabot. So
they'll be fine. I think they'll cope.
So the nice thing is it's given me a little priority order of things to do. And I've actually really appreciated running this little thing to just say, tell me what I should do, because now I've got a checklist and all I've got to do is just do all those things on the checklist. And the next time I run it, it'll be a lot cleaner. It's not perfect. There's other things I could do to improve, but I actually think that's a good starting point to just get myself closer to my panacea of Martin Wimpress level GitHub org prettiness. I haven't got all the animated stuff and all the automation in the README and stuff like that, but I'm getting there.
So once you've knocked down the list of things that you've identified, GitHub do have a feature which is community health, which tells you things like this, like you don't have a contributing document, you don't have a security policy, you don't have a license, or you don't have a COC. There's a whole bunch of sort of things along those lines that it sort of coerces you. You don't have issue templates or pull request templates, things like that. So that could be your next stopping point.
Yeah, and like the builder who maintains his own house.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm at work, all the repos I create for work, I do all of that. And mm-hmm. I make sure there is a security file. I'll do a pull request and make sure that all my commits are signed off and they're all GPG signed or whatever. But for my own ones, I don't. And it's really stupid. I really should. So yes, 2026 is the year that I get my GitHub repos in order. And this is the first step. And if anyone has any suggestions for other things I could do, and if you suggest moving everything off of GitHub, then I'll just ignore that. But if you've got any reasonable suggestions for how I can improve this mess, I would love to hear it. All the contact details are on the website. Thank you.
I have been getting more lazy with Git. I have been exploring other Git client options after being a long-time Gitkraken user. I went hunting for my next Git client hit, and I have found where I'm going to land with that.
Sorry, can I just say, given my previous segment, I thought for a minute you were going to tear down all this image I have if you're going to become more lazy with Git. I know you're a big fan of Gitkraken. What have you found that can possibly beat that?
Well, I'll get into what I found. I found two things and I've picked one, but I think it's probably important to describe why I went looking. So I do, I've been a long time subscriber to Gitkraken Pro, I think for maybe 10 years or more. For the last couple of years, for a couple of organizations I've worked for, you mentioned Git signing earlier, they have sort of specific Git signing requirements, and mm-hmm. Gitkraken hasn't been keeping pace with the various things you can do in terms of signing off commits automatically or signing commits in anything other than using GPG keys. And I'm allergic to GPG, so I switched to signing my commits for my personal projects with SSH keys when that feature landed in Git, which is something Gitkraken has implemented, but for a while it didn't have. So I'd be staging all of my stuff and preparing commit messages and then dropping into the terminal and then doing the finishing off in the terminal where I could do everything I needed to do. And then Gitkraken landed support for that, and so I carried on my merry way for another couple of years, continuing to use Gitkraken. But at my current job, we have to sign off all of our commits, or rather Git sign our commits with Sigstore, and Gitkraken has no support for that whatsoever. And that's become a pain. So I went looking, and also I'm gravitating towards developer workflows in the terminal. And that's not because I'm some sort of terminal hipster. It's just maybe I am a bit, but it's just convenient that I've got, laptops and remote servers and like remote VMs that I do work development in. And whilst I could scaffold up like desktop-y type things, it's a faff. So I want to do more in the terminal. So I went looking for something that was in the terminal that could compete with the convenience of Gitkraken and do all of the complicated Git workflows that I have without me having to learn all of the sort of linguistics of Git and its idioms in the command line.
I was going to say, please, sir, is the answer just use Git? Just learn it?
No, it's not. No, okay. That is never the answer.
Okay, so the second question is the answer GH?
No, because that's GitHub specific. So I'm particularly talking about Git here. So it doesn't actually matter whether or not you're working with pushing stuff to Git or GitLab or Codeberg or whatever it might be. This is purely Git operations. So it's things like branching, staging hunks, squashing commits, all of that sort of stuff that you'll learn about one day, Alan.
Sorry, you said staging hunks and it just threw me a bit.
Well, I can see a hunk right now, but it's
you're welcome. It's
off topic. Anyway,
that sort of thing where you want to do like partial commits of what you've got like work in progress is the big thing for me, which doing it just with the standard Git command line is never going to be suitable.
No, exactly. So more so when I'm working on personal projects, I might have an hour and a half, and I just want to work on stuff. And I don't think about it feature by feature. I will scattergun around the code and work on things. And maybe there's three or four things I've worked on, discrete features, but it's all just been plowed out.
You're destroying this image that I have of you as a professional developer.
Fine. That's fine.
That's why you can rewrite Git history.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But then you can stage things logically. So if I did a bit of work on authentication, I can just pick those lines rather than just stage the whole thing and commit it and go random assortment of stuff. I can pick out all the authentication bits and say, refactor the authentication, and then pick out all the bits to do with like image processing and stage that separately. Anyway, I went hunting and I started this a couple of years ago. And like I say, I then didn't need to follow through because Gitkraken did land the SSH signing, which was my big pain point. And back then I found Git UI and I really wanted to love Git UI, which is a terminal based application. It's written in Rust. So obviously it runs at a million miles an hour and it must be amazing because it's written in Rust. But I bounced off it. And the reason is that they have a very sort of opinionated view that everything in Git UI has to be implemented in native Rust. They are not prepared to call out to any external tools. And so that means that when I found it 2 years ago, it didn't have SSH key signing support, because that requires like shelling out to SSH and things, right? Or yeah. other tools to do the signing. I think maybe GPG weirdly is still used for signing with SSH keys. Anyway, roll on 2 years, when I went back to look at it, that issue is still open and unsolved for the same reasons that they still need to port various libraries or re-implement things in Rust. So this is an example of sort of opinionated views getting in the way of actually sort of being useful. So whilst I really like the look of it, as in the aesthetics and the way it's designed, it just simply doesn't support either of the gear signing workflows that I need. And back then, 2 years ago, I also looked at a tool called LazyGit. And that didn't stick with me, because when I tried it 2 years ago, in contrast to Git UI, it looked a bit chaotic. Git UI shows you sort of on screen what the key binds are for the various like Git operations. So it's very easy to see, oh yeah, this is how I commit, this is how I reword, this is how I push. And there was none of that. So you kept on having to invoke the unsignposted help and scroll down this big long list of stuff. So I jumped off away from LazyGit because it just didn't click with me and I didn't know how to use it. But coming back to it 2 years later and really wanting to find something, I discovered by reading the fine manual that there's a couple of options in LazyGit which are not default, and I think they should be, which put in the bottom status bar the keybinds for the common operations for whatever pane or panel you're currently in. And as soon as I found that and turned it on, it completely transformed the usability and accessibility of LazyGit. And it was immediately like, oh, well, okay, I can now see that, you know, if I want to commit now, I just press C. And so that was sort of the on-ramp to really sort of clicking with LazyGit. And once I found that, I've been off to the races and I've got so many nice things to say about LazyGit now I'm up and running with it.
It's interesting. I use a couple of GUI tools for most of my Git stuff because I'm developing in PHP Storm, which is JetBrains IDE. And their Git stuff in there is pretty good. And the main thing I use it for is doing fix-up commits and interactive rebases to squash those, because that's something I do quite a lot as part of Moodle's code review process. You can like right-click on any commit and say, create a fix-up commit based on like the current changes. And you can do partial commits. It like gives you a checkbox next to each change, but actually doing it that way is a bit of a faff. So when I want to do my commits and particularly either amending commits or splitting them up or doing a partial commit of what my current changes are, is I use a tool called Git Cola.
Yes.
Which is I invoke from the terminal by typing Git Cola, but then it's actually a Python cute application which opens in a separate window. So that being able to do that in the terminal within PHP Storm rather than having to open a separate GUI might actually be quite a nice workflow for me, just for those operations where I don't want to use PHP Storm's Git features.
Right. Yeah, so Git Cola is what I used to use before I switched to Git Kraken a long, long time ago. And I've also, for the longest time, turned off all Git integrations in my IDEs. So I keep these things quite separate from one another. I do code over here and I do code staging and committing over there.
Yeah.
So yeah, now I'm using LazyGit. I suppose the first thing to point out is that unlike Git UI, this one is implemented in Go, which now, you know, strokes a certain friendliness with me as I've been learning Go in recent months. And it's a TUI as well, but it wraps itself around Git, the command line. So all of those sort of esoteric like Git signing and Git sign off features that I want to use just work, because if you've got Git configured to do those things, when it does its thing, it just hands that off to Git and Git does the right thing. So that meant that all of the stuff I needed to do with automatic sign off, automatic signing on some repositories with SSH keys and on other repositories using Sigstore, that all works now. And so I'm very happy with that whole flow. And like you say, it's got really nice tools to support all of the common flows that I use. So you mentioned interactive rebasing, that's a thing, and then like line level hunk staging. And the key thing is that whilst I've learned now all of its little key combinations, I haven't rebound any of them, although you could do that if you wanted to. I just go with the defaults, because once you get used to them, they're quite sane. And while I'm fast with that, it also responds to the mouse. So although it's a TUI, it's got a very nice, It's a pretty TUI with, you know, curvy like surrounds and all the rest of it. But you can just click on everything. And for me, it's a bit like what I talked about last week, where Zed was just simply more responsive than VS Code. And Gitkraken is another browser posing as a Git client. and so using Lazy Git, it is suddenly immediately responsive for everything I do, because it is just a Go application that is a Git client. And so I click on things and I create branches and push things around. It's all fantastic. And of course, killer feature, it integrates with Capuchin. So it looks beautiful too. And a bit like VS Code, it's been 4 weeks now, and I haven't opened Gitkraken once in that time. And in fact, like VS Code, I've also disabled Gitkraken in my Nix configuration, so it, to all intents and purposes, it's gone. And I finally took the decision to cancel my Gitkraken subscription. I have moved over to Lazy Git, and it is the way I do Git now.